Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the new car is in the driveway, and for many new faces looking at committee and subcommittee leadership positions in the Congress, it's a day to push the pedal to the floor. With no Democrats to block things in the Senate, for some lawmakers, it looks like a straight stretch of smooth pavement as far as you can see. Now, there is a presidential veto wall out there somewhere, yikes, but on opening day for the 114th Congress and a new majority in both the House and the Senate for the Republicans for the first time since 2006, who wants to wreck the Republican family hot rod? For Republican Congressman Rob Bishop, representing Utah's 1st Congressional District, today is his first day as chair of the House Natural Resources Committee. He joins me now. Welcome, Congressman.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me on.
So what does this new leadership position on this committee allow you to think about doing, to push as an agenda with your confidence that your counterparts in the Senate will be supporting you this time?
Well, I do have a great deal of confidence this time. Stuff that we pass on the House will be able to be discussed in the Senate, and I think much of it will be passed. The Natural Resource Committee deals with a wide variety of issues, all affecting federal lands in some way, going from energy to water development to land issues to Native American issues.
Do you support a reduction in federal control of lands in the United States?
Well, you have to realize the federal government currently controls one-third of the land mass of the United States, and it was never intended to be that way. Anything we can do to empower state, local, and tribal people to have greater say on what is happening in their areas is a plus. And especially if we can do it so that we take the issues out of the courts. The courts are a lousy way of trying to create some kind of land policy and put it back in the legislative approach where people have some input. That's the ideal situation. Yeah, we're going to move in that direction.
Isn't it the case, though, that most of that acreage you refer to is in Alaska?
No. In fact, it is one of those disconnects that people think about. Most people, when they think of public lands, think of a national park. National parks are only 13% of the land that the federal government actually controls and owns. The bulk is in BLM land, which is almost all west of Denver. States like Utah, which is 70% owned by the federal government, Nevada is 90%, Alaska is 90%. Those are the states that have the bulk of these kinds of lands. And so it's a disconnect when people think about public lands, what it actually means to be a public land state.
Do you support the harvesting of old-growth timber on Bureau of Land Management land?
Actually, the timber harvesting goes from the Forest Service, which is still under our jurisdiction, but it's actually part of the Department of Agriculture in a convoluted way we have organized policy issues in Washington. Old-growth timber should be harvested if you want to have a healthy forest. Clear-cutting is different than just harvesting. If you actually want to have trees that are having the room to grow, so that habitat takes place, there is place for greater animal life that takes place, and you can reduce the amount of disease that destroys forests, you have to do some kind of regular thinning of forests. It's happened throughout history, and it's either done mechanically by man or it's done by fires of some kind. There is a better way of doing it. So, yeah, there should be some kind of thinning of the forest if you want to have a healthy forest system.
Congressman Bishop, do you support going back to the policies of the Bush administration in the very, very liberal granting of mineral licenses and extraction permits for drilling in federal lands, especially thinking about the price of oil declining now?
Well, the Bush administration was not all that liberal in what they were doing in the first place. And the second area is what we need to have is a consistent policy. And that's where Energy and Commerce Committee deals with energy issues on private land. My committee deals with energy issues on public land, and we need to be consistent with the two of 10% of energy development, both onshore and offshore. I need to work with that other committee to come up with a policy that is consistent for the United States.
But how would you prevent industry officials from being responsible for granting drilling licenses, as was the case discovered during the Bush administration? How would you regulate that?
Now, you can there are a couple of different layers you can do that. First of all, there are still regulatory issues in the federal government, but if you were actually to turn over a lot of these decision-making abilities to state and local authorities and tribal authorities who live on the land, who need the land, who understand the land, you can have a much better and more direct decision that impacts localities. A one-size-fits-all program coming from Washington may be a cliché, but it's still a true cliché. That is a lousy way of doing things, and going to the courts to make those decisions is an even worse way of making those kind of policy decisions. So it's not necessarily if there should be some kind of regulatory decisions, but who should be making those regulatory decisions.
Congressman Bishop, we have to move on, but one last thing for you. Is there a policy issue, an initiative that you see clear sailing now with a Republican majority in both houses?
I hope we can do a lot of those, not only in coming with a comprehensive energy program, but a water development, especially in the drought cycle the West is in, a hydropower development, empowering Native Americans, and also empowering state and local governments and tribes to have greater say in how their lands are used and developed. All those things, I think, will have a better chance of being discussed now that the Senate has the free ability to actually discuss things without a heavy-handed Senate leadership kind of limiting what their discussion issues are in the first place.
Well, good luck, Congressman Rob Bishop, and may you avoid vetoes in your next 2 years.
We have a unique Secretary of Interior who has a business background. She's not the typical politician placed in those positions. And I think there is a chance of doing a lot of things that people didn't think were possible with the unique characters that are currently involved in the decision-making authority. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to being able to get some stuff done.
Some bipartisanship and optimism from Rob Bishop. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Rob Bishop represents Utah's 1st Congressional District. Voters in blue and red states certainly have sharply divergent views about their sense of wealth and the health of their local economies. Political ideology attracts certain kinds of businesses, or is it that certain businesses attract people with a certain distinct set of ideologies? Richard Florida, director for the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto and editor-at-large of CityLab.com, investigated the taxonomy, so to speak, of red state and blue state economies in a piece for the New York Times. Richard Florida, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be with you, John.
What's predictable and what's surprising about what you looked at here?
Well, I think you said it very nicely in your setup. I started to really agonize over this in the wake of the very red-looking election, you know, the midterms. And why would Americans, especially in states that are not generating the highest wage jobs, they're not particularly these good high-tech knowledge jobs, they're construction jobs, their energy jobs, why would people be electing conservative politicians? And of course, there's explanations about values and religion. And when I looked at the data and what other people have been writing, what I found out is that these red states that many of us in the blue states, you know, sometimes look down our noses at, are doing a better job of delivering what I would call the traditional leave it to beaver American dream. Even though wages are lower, even though these are not the high tech whiz bang jobs, the people who are working in those jobs or moving to these states can afford, you know, a suburban home. It may not be the most up to date, you know, Tribeca loft or, you know, transit served suburban, old suburban walkable neighborhood. But it's a traditional American dream, and even though their wages are lower, their quality of life is more affordable. And that was what the puzzle is. And I think, you know, you hear politicians like Rick Perry now, as he's governor of Texas, trying to gear up potentially for a presidential campaign, saying, you know, we can deliver you a version of the American dream without a whole lot of government intervention. We can do this on the cheap. So that's what the piece tries to say, that the red states are delivering a version of the American dream, popular with a certain segment of the population, and this is something very real and that we have to grapple with.
Because blue states rely on educated economy, arts economy, financial economy. Do they sound more elitist and have a difficult political challenge before them?
I think the blue states, and particularly the metros and cities, the New Yorks, the San Franciscos, the Bostons, the Seattles, and I could go on. Everybody knows the examples of those places, are very expensive. Their economies are very expensive to operate. They require big-scale research and development institutions, both private but also very expensive to operate, public universities, which require, although it's diminishing, require state funding. They require, in the biggest of these cities, transit, which is about the biggest ticket item you can imagine. They require subways, or they require some kind of fast rail, light rail. They have higher degrees of density. They have much higher housing prices because they haven't built enough housing, because more and more of these high-tech professionals and others are financial people, and even some of these globally wealthy people want to live there. And then, you know, ironically, but quite clearly, because of all of this, inequality is surging in the blue, you know, where you would, I guess, expect it. I was going to say least expect it, but where you would expect it. Because of the surge in these knowledge jobs, which pay a lot, inequality is surging, which means these states and communities have to pay more for social welfare services, affordable housing, to deal with gentrification. So their cost structures of these knowledge economies are higher, and people, you know, are getting hit with more expensive housing. You know, they can't necessarily afford to live near transit. Great study, by the way, by my colleague at NYU, Mitchell Moss, which says that living near transit increases your economic opportunity about as much as a college degree.
Wow.
Quite astounding. So for all of these factors, life in the blue states has become quite a bit harder than this easier life, you know, with a house and a shorter commute. They're not as congested, they're not as large in a red state economy. And in that, and I think that's what's underpinning these two Americas, these two very different kinds of economies, a cheaper, an American dream on the cheap in the red areas, a waning old American dream, perhaps a new dream emerging of transit to work, but life in a much smaller apartment or condo or townhome, which are much more, you know, difficulties and much higher taxes in the blue economies.
Well, the specific state to state are fascinating to look at, and I would urge people to look at this piece in the New York Times or go to citylab.com. But before we go, you're describing a situation where there's not a lot of, and I guess we intuitively understand this, there's not a lot of shared experience between this red state American dream and this blue state American dream. They're looking very differently at the same nation.
I think the worry is that this red state dream on the cheap becomes one that more Americans buy in, when really our only path to the future is as a stronger technology, innovation-driven, and knowledge economy, which is going to cost all of us more money, and we're going to have to chip in.
So that's a challenge for the Democrats in 2016, unless they can really gear up prosperity in the blue states.
I think the challenge for the Democrats is that they don't have a vision of a broad prosperity, of an FDR-like prosperity, which could lift all boats. Hmm. Their vision of an economy is one that delivers the goods to the knowledge worker, and then perhaps of some kind of subsidies or support for the less fortunate kind of... Bill de Blasio typifies this, and I do like the mayor, but I think we need a vision of a progressive America where all can benefit.
Looking for a vision, Richard Florida, director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto and editor-at-large of citylab.com. Thanks, Richard.
Delightful being with you. Thank you.
In the city of Boston, the people will speak eventually, or at least 12 jurors will get to rule in open court and deliver a verdict in the Boston bombing criminal trial. Jury selection is this week. After that, those jurors will be free to speak to reporters or to avoid them. Such is not the case in the explosive grand jury proceedings that set off riots and protests in New York and Ferguson, when secret grand juries declined to indict officers for their use of deadly force against unarmed suspects. But an unnamed member of the grand jury in the case of Darren Wilson, shooter of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that juror wants to speak. The juror has filed a lawsuit against St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri has joined that case. They allege the Darren Wilson case is unique and that typical grand jury rules should not apply. Joining us is Peter Joy, law professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
And what are the circumstances under which grand jurors ever speak, ever have their testimony released out of the secret proceedings of the grand jury?
That would only be in a situation where somebody testified before the grand jury and the prosecutor believed that they lied, so they prosecuted the person then for perjury, and either the defendant in that case or the prosecutor wanted to use a grand jury member to be a witness in a case. So it's a very limited situation where you would hear from a grand juror.
So the best that could happen in this American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit in the Ferguson case would be that certain grand jurors would be allowed to speak publicly about their impressions of the proceedings, or would there be a transcript that would be released as well? And I'm wondering what the argument would be. Do they have to prove some, the grand jury was railroaded kind of issue, some test issue?
Yeah, so I guess there are a couple questions there. And the last one is, this particular grand juror who is the named plaintiff in the lawsuit is saying that the prosecutor had mischaracterized what the grand jury did when he made his statement at the press conference. It was called right after they decided not to bring back an indictment. And so this grand juror is saying, I want to have my say. I want to talk about my impressions. And also I want to talk to my family members, because the grand jurors are even prohibited by law from discussing what happened with their family members. So that's what this particular grand juror is saying, I'd like to do. And in terms of the transcript, in this particular case, the prosecutor has already released transcripts of the witness's testimony. Now, there have been some redactions. So, for example, the names of the witnesses have all been redacted except for Officer Wilson, who killed Michael Brown, and also for Michael Brown's companion on that day. But all the other witnesses' names were redacted, and there were also some other redactions. So the transcript's already out there.
It's hard to imagine what test there would be, in that the supposition is that a prosecutor has a lot of discretion with a grand jury and can encourage a grand jury to go in whatever direction the prosecutor wants, with some limitations. There's no way to really say that a grand jury is railroaded, since on some level that's kind of what we expect. True?
Well, yeah, that's right. And the other thing that some people don't know is, even if this grand jury had returned an indictment, the prosecutor has the authority to decide not to go forward with the case or to dismiss the case, in the middle of a trial. So the fact that a grand jury returns an indictment does not mean that the prosecutor has to prosecute somebody. So there's a whole lot of discretion that the prosecutor has.
And do the unique circumstances of the aftermath of the Ferguson shooting and the failure to indict render any of the legal restrictions on releasing testimony in a different light? I mean, are those circumstances important to the court?
Well, I think the most important thing to the court is the fact that so much of the transcript has already been released, and also that the prosecutor has characterized the grand jury's decision in a way that this particular grand juror says is not correct. So I think that those are the most compelling facts in favor of letting this grand juror speak. But there are also, I think, good arguments against letting this grand juror speak.
All right, if you could step out of your professorial objectivity for a moment, what do you think? Just a gut check. Does this stink?
No. I mean, well, when you say, does this stink? I don't think this lawsuit stinks. I think that this particular grand juror, has a point. Is it going to be compelling enough to convince a judge to let the grand juror speak? That I'm doubtful of. I think that there's also the interest of the other grand jurors. I wouldn't be surprised if we see the possibility of one or more of the other grand jurors intervening in this case to say, no, we don't want anybody to talk about our deliberations. And so that's one of the other things that is, I think, lurking in this lawsuit, is the fact that we might find out that the grand jury, actually a majority of them, may have wanted to bring back an indictment, but a majority isn't enough.
Peter Joy, law professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Thanks so much.
Okay, and thank you very much.
For the GOP in the brand new 114th Congress, the way Congress calculates tax revenue from new legislation doesn't appear to add up. With an all-Republican Congress, the supposedly independent Congressional Budget Office, with members from the House and Senate, is much more malleable under this Congress. The GOP wants to change the algorithms, or some sort of math formula, used to project the money from new laws. With the new math, costs may not look so bad, taxes might not look so onerous. With us is Charlie Herman, the business editor here at WNYC News. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, John.
How controversial is something like this?
It's funny. I mean, this sounds like just an accounting rule that may not be that important, but the word for it is called dynamic scoring. And basically, this is the idea of trying to account for what happens when you actually implement a tax cut. So if the government were to, say, cut taxes dramatically for corporations, would that lead to corporations spending more money? Would that boost the economy? Right now, the way things are estimated is that when there's a tax cut that they don't really look at the budget, when they're making an analysis of it, these nonpartisan offices, they don't really take into account what is the economic growth, what's the impact of that. So what Republicans want is, when we cut taxes, which we want to do, we want you to account for how much economic growth there is, because if there's a huge growth, then that will reduce the need to find ways to pay for these tax cuts.
It's a little bit of Reaganomics, in the sense of reducing taxes causes more growth and therefore more revenue.
And that's where the Democrats come in. That's where those on the left say, look, this is trickle-down economics. This did not work. Look at the Bush tax cuts from earlier in the 2000s. That led to large deficits. So if you go about this, if you make this accounting change, it'll make things look really good on paper, but you're not really paying for the tax cuts. And if deficits do grow, then you Republicans are going to come back and say, oh, look, we need to cut spending on these other programs, when it's more that the tax cuts themselves were never paid for.
Well, of course, this is important because during the Bush administration, during the Obama administration, new legislation was always tested on the basis of whether the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, said it was going to be revenue neutral or determined what the actual cost was going to be. And the members of Congress on both sides of the aisle lived with that. Would this constitute a hijacking of that supposedly independent test?
I think Democrats would feel that this is a hijacking, that you would be making this office, which the Congressional Budget Office, which gets criticized by the left and the right, that you would be making it partisan, that it would be making decisions that would justify the tax cuts that Republicans want to put in place. You know, right now, the way that the CBO operates is that if there is a boost to the economy from legislation and it produces lower deficits, they'll go back and say, hey, this actually improved our fiscal outlook. The economy looks better. If there's no economic boost, then they don't have to make any changes because they always sort of estimated that it would be neutral. So it is a little bit – it's a little wonky, but it's really important because it goes to how do you pay for things like tax cuts. And, you know, other people will point out, well, if we're going to look at how tax cuts affect the economy, then why not look at how government spending actually can grow the economy? Why not look at education? If we spend a lot of money on education, down the road, people will be better educated. They may get better jobs, get paid better, pay more taxes. That these things aren't very simple, and the worry is just politicizing this office, which everyone criticizes. You know, sometimes the Democrats are really angry with it, and sometimes Republicans are really angry with it.
Well, what do the gallery of wonks think, the economists, about what the CBO does? Do they care?
If you look at a lot of the economists who ran the CBO, both for Republicans and for Democrats who are both to the left and the right, most of them are coming along the lines of, this may not be the best way to go. And by the way, just because you changed to dynamic scoring doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to show that tax cuts actually help.
It's a question for Zwillick, but you think this is going to pass?
It looks very likely that this could go through. The big question is, who's going to run the Congressional Budget Office? Do they keep this nonpartisan person in there, or do Republicans choose someone that gets people really upset and says, this person you're choosing is going to be biased?
Charlie Herman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Business and economics editor at WNYC. Unforgettable. But in a quick century, the piano has gone from household entertainment center, where people gathered to play and sing music of all genres, to more of an enormous piece of furniture that is rarely played except in exceptionally musical households. More likely, it's a digital keyboard playing along with MP3 players and a DJ. Back in the ragtime era of 1909, more than 364,000 pianos were sold. Now, annual sales are right around a dreary 30,000 to 40,000, competing with stereos, DJs, synthesizers, soloists, rhythm machines, the artist Moby here, and of course, headphones. And you can even plink around on a decent-sounding piano on your own smartphone. If you have fat fingers like I do. Ah, yes. Well, Stephen Scarborough joins us. He's a second-generation piano tuner and technician, owner of Indie Tuner in Indianapolis. Hello, Stephen.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And you recognize that melody, right?
Partly.
Yeah. And but I wonder if you look around the piano universe these days, it sounds a little more like this to your ears.
You know, I think so, yeah.
What's happening? Are pianos vanishing? I mean, those are draconian numbers going back to 1909. There are still pianos around, but are you thinking about, you know, going back to school?
You know, that's a good question. You know, pianos, I agree, sales are vanishing, but a piano's a hard thing to disappear, for sure. It's a great hand-me-down that's being passed down from generation to generation. You know, I hear a lot in my line of work, you know, grandmother gave me our piano and we want our kids to learn. Can you come and fix it? So I think, you know, while sales are definitely going down, it's hard to get rid of a piano. So I'm not worried as far as that goes.
Do a little anthropology for me here. What kind of home typically has a bunch of really active piano students in it? And what kind of pianos are we talking about in this case in the 21st century?
Definitely the family who places priority on self-discipline, the type of family who has a respect for, you know, arts, music, the romantic arts, people who kind of found that road on their own, who found interest in piano on their own or other music instruments and went to school for it. You know, they tend to have a piano in the house because it's a, you know, a great way to translate scale to other areas of music and to teach and learn on. So,
would you say, Stephen, that a learning piano these days is a big upright, a tiny little spinet upright, or one of these electric pianos?
It's a little bit of everything. It kind of just depends on the family's budget and their priorities. For the most part, I tune kind of medium-sized uprights in the home. I also work at the Jordan College of Arts for Butler University. And many of their pianos are grand pianos and studio pianos, and many of the people that take lessons from there are urged to upgrade their piano as they get more involved in their craft. So, you know, it's a little bit of a range.
Can you take me into a household that really most resembles what it might have looked like in a living room, say, in the early 1900s, late 1800s even, where the piano is at the center of the parlor, there's a huge amount of music that's dog-eared and clearly marked with notation, and here's someone who needs that piano in tune and plays quite a lot, and you might even hear them play if you come to tune.
You know, we're talking back in the early 1900s, you know, very little forms of entertainment. This is, you know, pre-radio, and if you wanted entertainment or music or something to interact with in the house or in a place of, you know, place of business or a restaurant or a bar, you know, you had to hire a musician or a pianist. And if you wanted that in your home, you had to have instruments in your home. And, you know, the rich and the affluent, they bought pianos, and in order to entertain themselves, they learned how to play the piano on their own, and they did that there. And things have obviously changed a bit since then, but you know, there's a lot more substitutes for sure.
Do you have a client that resembles the old days?
You know, I do. I have a handful, you know, and most of them are, you know, classically trained pianists, or they have a huge love for the instrument and one of their children play. And you know, I hear a lot of stories, especially around holidays is when business picks up. You know, they have the tradition of sitting around their piano and playing Christmas carols or hearing their daughter play because she's away at college and is home for the weekend. And, you know, it still happens, just I think on a smaller level.
Do you have a piano in your home, Stephen?
I sure do, yes. I have a couple, actually.
What kinds?
One is a Baldwin. It's a Baby Grand. Also, I'm sitting right next to a Fender Rhodes. It's an electronic keyboard.
And that's a keyboard that actually has action to it, where it's hammers hitting tuning forks.
It does, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, Stephen, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, absolutely.
And good playing today.
Thank you.
And
may you
have many clients throughout this century.
I appreciate that.
Stephen Scarborough is a second-generation piano tuner and technician, owner of Indie Tuner in Indianapolis. Have you decided where you stand on the fate of Boston bombing suspect Jokhar Tsarnaev? Would you like to serve on that jury, and could you serve impartially?
Hi, this is Terry from Portland, Oregon, and I think the Tsarnaev trial is really a foregone conclusion. I don't think anybody is really debating his innocence or guilt. I think it comes down to how you feel about the death penalty. And for me, I would say if the state allows it, I would default to the will of the victims as best I could know it.
This is Pat Rangel calling from Dallas, Texas. Yes, I could serve on the jury. I'd be proud to serve. I could do it. I make tough decisions all the time.
Love the stories and love the diversity of views on all this. Tell us at 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.